From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, special guest Steven joins as Joey asks me, Jess, about how feelings are contagious, and I ask Joey about the effects of everyone meeting online.
Woo! Oh, hi! This is what a Joey sounds like.
This is what a special guest Steven sounds like.
And this is what an emotional booster shot Jess Vander sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess.
We have emotions.
We have emotions and we get emotionally vaccinated.
Hi, Aaron. We miss you. Okay, bye.
I'm right here.
Sorry, Steven.
But also, Steven, welcome.
Yeah. Hello. It's great to be here.
Steven, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Steven, and I joined the Sylvain Labs team two months ago. Months ago, just wild.
Wow.
It was like yesterday.
That's how you define yourself as a person?
Yeah, that is me, fully and truly. Yeah, originally from Richmond, where our other offices, literally everything about me is related to this company in some way. But yeah.
You identified quickly.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. Just in group very, very fast. So, but yeah, excited to be here.
Well, have we got some topics for you today?
Have we got topics?
So I read an article last week that made me think a lot about emotions, which I'm just basically always all in my emotions anyways. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because it felt counter in my mind to the way that we've been increasingly talking about emotions. And so this article was based on a Yale study. I think the article was on NPR.com or something like that. But it's a Yale study about how contagious emotions are. And it basically talks about emotions, you know, positive or negative, and how they can spread like the flu. And they'd done a study around how anger like rapidly spreads through communities by monitoring interactions over time and seeing like, when someone's angry, you know, you kind of kick the dog or kick your neighbor or whatever it is, and sort of runs downhill. But historically, we kind of had this relationship with emotions where we kept it to ourselves. And today, we're very much in the like, you know, tell your true story, spill the tea, like all of this business. And we're putting emotions out in public, good, bad, or otherwise. And it made me start to question whether that's good or bad. And ultimately, like, what is our responsibility with our emotions?
It's funny because I think normally think about this, or at least I do, of like watching somebody cry in a movie makes me cry almost certainly, right? Like every single time. But what you're talking about sounds a lot more substantial. Like, this is bigger. This isn't just a moment where you're crying and somebody else is crying. This is like the timeline of people and how it could make people more angry, as you know, for years, not just a minute.
Yeah, there is like a cascade effect, right? Like, I'm mean to you, and then you're mean to the barista, and then the barista is mean to the grocery store person, and they're mean to their wife, and like all of a sudden these things just kind of trickle on and carry out.
It's an interesting question about when you have a responsibility to care not only for your emotions, but to care for your emotions as an impactor of someone else's emotions. I used to think about this a lot as a barista, specifically of like, there is a very small interaction people have with you, and you have a significant ability when they're in a like a vulnerable pre-coffee state of influencing how they react and how they feel. And little moments of trying to like inject positivity into quiet moments is like the positive version of that. But what is the negative?
Yeah.
I think also that's an interesting part of being new to a company, is seeing what the emotional climate is like, and seeing how like a new person, as your responsibility is to some way, like, is it to fit into that climate? Is it to shape it positively in some way? And navigating that space is super challenging and super interesting.
Yeah, for a while, to your barista point, at some point got this idea in my head. I was like, you know, and I worked in the service industry a lot when I was young, like all through my teens. And I would go into a coffee shop in New York and I would just be like, oh man, this person is like on a conveyor belt, just like cranking these things out. And I would just try to be like, I would say like something as simple as like, how are you doing today? And they it would sort of like snap them up and they'd kind of like look at me funny and then just be like, oh, I'm good. And the interaction was nothing more than that. But they started giving me positive reinforcement because I started getting free coffees sometimes.
For being nice.
Yeah, just for being nice. And I was just like, oh, like clearly this is, I wasn't doing it to get free coffee. I was just like, this person is probably like, you know, not getting acknowledged as a person very often. So I just thought I would start saying like, hey, how you doing? And
yeah,
it clearly meant something.
It's an all too common reminder, and maybe even more so now, that those positive actions, or you know, putting out happy feelings basically, is actually really meaningful. And I think probably more commonly and more longitudinally, this idea of like feelings affecting people over a while is more typically thought of with, you know, children and trauma and their experiences as kids than, you know, turning out a certain way later on, looking at twins. Whereas this is like, you know, what could a happy barista conversation do for you forever, given that you're always on your phone and otherwise not interacting with humanity?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a lot about like unexpected moments. And especially when, I mean, you brought up the point of like, we're introducing on a broader scale emotions into a new way, which it's like the inverse. It's the shadow of cancel culture and it's the shadow of call out culture, of as more and more things come to light and as we want to hold more and more people accountable, that gives rise to significant and earnest feelings of anger. And so finding ways to counter that in some like simple, ordinary way becomes that much more powerful because the climate is so defined by a moment of, yeah, darkness, tenseness, and anger.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think call-out culture is like an interesting example because you see it actually spread like a contagion. That's how they talk about it in this. Like there are emotional contagions. Mm. And when people get upset, right, wrong, or otherwise, the upsetness spreads through social media like a virus or a flu, right? And I was reflecting on something on Twitter by myself, you know, speaking to myself on Twitter, I'd seen like a photo of someone posting a picture of them crying, which I'd seen plenty of these in the past. And I reflected, like, is this a symptom or the antidote to what is sort of wrong with social media broadly? Of like, is it good that people are sharing like when they're sad, or is it bad? But that was before I had read this article. And now it makes me sort of reevaluate, like historically in the US and in Western culture, you had this vibe of like, keep your emotions to yourself for whatever reason, whether it was for the good of the community or not. And now we're saying, share your emotions out in the world, good, bad, or otherwise. But if we're in like a bad time, it feels like sharing your emotions perpetuates bad times.
Yeah, it's funny because on one hand, there's the shift from not sharing your feels to be very vocal about your feels in every way you can. That's one side of it. And then there's maybe another side too of the capacity that we have to share our feelings, not only more broadly, but more intensely, that we can share a video of something that is so vivid and so powerful. You know, I can only imagine that there's this distance when you read about a thing in writing that happened at a time or even a place recently that's farther away. But when you can see more and experience more, I think it's easier to feel and like have that virus spread faster.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't know, like, does it mean, you know, like there, I have such like a conflict about this idea of like, if I'm feeling bad, am I supposed to not tell other people because I care about them? Or am I supposed to tell other people because it's healthy for me? But clearly there is going to be an impact either way. And I don't know which way it's the right way to handle this situation.
Yeah, it makes me think of like who we give license to feel and who we give space to like navigate their emotions in public.
Yeah.
And the shifts between the relationship between how men are expected or not expected. I mean, there's a lot in the midst of like early stages of the Democratic nominees. You see like the differences between how Beto was allowed to present himself versus female candidates and mm-hmm. the relationship that has with how men are allowed to express themselves and how they're not, and what that looks like playing out on a more global stage.
I assume you're talking Beto O'Rourke of Texas, right?
Yes,
I don't know the story.
Yeah, so he's been present as he's continued to launch his presidential campaign. There have been a lot of instances of him saying things and taking actions that have been perceived as like things he can get away with as a guy that a woman could never get away with. So whether that's like talking about his relationship with his family and how like my job as a husband like has come second to my political career, and he's trying to be like a supportive feminist and saying like my wife is doing all of this great work, and at the same time is saying things that like a woman could never get away with. He's like jumping on tables and showing like righteousness and excitement and joy and power in ways that would be seen as conflicting and express an entirely different emotion when projected from a female point of view. And so it's a sort of fascinating microcosm to see the way like emotional dynamics play out between men and women specifically.
Yeah, it's almost like depending on who you are, the strain of emotional contagion might be spread differently.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and you have like the gender dynamic is super interesting too, with sort of like shifts in masculinity and all of that stuff as well, right? Like boys don't cry. As this idea historically, like you're supposed to suppress your emotions, and if you're sad, hold it in, and all of that, like that, you know, we feel like those things are positive, and maybe I generally agree that it is positive, but I'm just wondering, like in these situations, even in like the work environment, right? Like if you're going through, if you're going through something working on a team, right? Like how do you then, what is the expectation of modulation of your emotions as it relates to maintaining the health of your community, right? Like the Yale study was about broader communities like towns or sort of like more extended communities, neighborhoods, things like that, and how even through people who don't know each other, like somehow these like reverberations or waves of anger can carry over to other people. So what, how does it reflect back on your own behavior, even in like your smaller communities, right? Like how are you supposed to navigate your emotions on a day-to-day basis, right? Like obviously good, you're supposed to like spread it out and like right. make everyone happy, but you can't be that all of the time. And so is it a question of appropriate expression? I'm assuming like anger specifically, which this study was about. Like I think they talk about other emotions being contagious, but anger is often inflicted on another person. And so maybe that is distinct from like sadness is just felt, you know?
Yeah, I think what it brings up is that, you know, your feelings affect other people. This is a thing that we know. And the more open we are about our feelings, the more it affects other people on, you know, a larger scale and on an interpersonal scale at work or with friends or whatever that is. And when I think that's, I don't know if it's saying something for better or for worse, right? Whether that's, it's more just about being responsible. Yeah. I think when we started off in that space, right? Like being, having a sense of responsibility for your feelings, or even just an awareness of, okay, well, I am very upset and I know what that's doing to the vibe right now. I struggle with this as somebody who has many, many feelings. This is known about me. But you're right. What does that say about my job to not either not feel or suppress those feels?
Yeah, that like the... Like, obviously, you care about the people that you're around, whether it's you work with or in your life. And so is it about being like, unemotional in the way that you express your emotions? Like, is that even possible?
Yeah, is the pendulum swinging back? I'm like, okay, too many feelings, guys. Reel it in.
And what's the responsibility for engaging in these communities where, like, the righteousness of anger makes you feel bad?
Yeah.
Like, how do we navigate these spaces where, like, yes, we want to hold people accountable. Yes, we want to express our frustrations and be in places where it is valid and good to feel these things and express these feelings, but also participating in those things and seeing those things reflected back at us makes us feel so much worse and contributes to pile on to the problem of the feelings we're feeling.
Well, yeah, that's sort of an interesting point, right? Like, we're going through this time where there are clearly social issues that we are grappling with, cultural issues that we are grappling with socially. And even among those issues that most people agree are, like, there are some of these, like, social cultural issues that have, like, 80%, right? Like, agreement, like, this thing is right or this thing is wrong, whatever it is. But the process of making systemic change is not happening when you're just sort of like, ha ha ha, like, you know, like, swinging your arms and, like, dancing around. It's like anger is a mechanism for creating systemic change. The issue is that if anger is contagious, that anger is going to spread to other people who aren't trying to make that change.
Oh, and so, no. And your enemy will also become angry. Yeah, and all the bees will be stoked into fury.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, the idea of, like, using anger to create change in this one area also means that that emotion generation that you're creating in this one area is spreading out to other people who are going to have to manage that anger in other ways, right? Like, that might be, like, the emotional change anger that we're putting in place to, like, create social change is also the result of why there are sort of, like, conspiracy theory nuts like QAnon and all of these other things.
Emotions don't have objectives.
Yeah, exactly.
That's applied by you.
Yeah.
This is an amazing idea of, it's not even about the thing or, like, whatever you're talking about. It's just like, I'm yelling and now you're yelling.
Yeah, exactly.
100%.
Like, yeah, someone starts yelling out of, like you said, like, righteousness. Like, right. I'm angry. Like, we need to change this. And then the next person's like, I'm angry and I have no idea why I'm angry.
Right. And eventually you end up in a spot where it's like, we're not in the same place. Yeah, like, we're not mad about the same thing.
This is not
thing
where we started.
Yeah. Like, that's not what I'm saying.
So the moral of the story is, what? You're responsible for your emotions and...
I mean,
this is not an answerable question.
Yeah, yeah. And not to be, like, pithy, and I don't know pithy, but I think about when I was a little kid and I used to get really, really frustrated. My mom's adage, which I'm sure many people heard, was like, you can control how you respond, which is different than how you feel.
Yeah.
And I think at the time she had read some magazine where Anne Hathaway was interviewed.
My spirit animal.
Fair enough. And her, like, takeaway quote, Anne Hathaway's takeaway quote was like, every day I wake up and choose joy. And I thought it was actually, as a child, really compelling of, like, oh, every day I can wake up and to some degree control what I'm going to put into the world and how I'm going to respond to the world.
Yeah.
And that can be different than the things I'm feeling, but what I choose to put in is something I do have control over. And so I am going to choose joy when I can.
This, you made me think of, I read another article this week about how Inuits raise their kids, Inuit tribes, and they just don't express anger outwardly. Like, they selectively choose, and so they teach their kids not to express anger. And so, like, your point about choosing joy is saying, like, I'm going to live in joy, and when I have the bad ones, I'm just going to, like, and maybe it's only about cutting off anger, but, you know, choose joy.
It's joy.
Thanks, Joey. So I am going to put in a tiny plug for my older brother's newsletter, The Link, because last week I read an article from it about the shifting nature of relationship timelines, which totally sells the newsletter. It's generally just about, like, cool stuff that's happening in the world and really whatever he feels like writing. And since he's my brother, we tend to find the same things interesting. And this particular thing caught my eye. Because there's a really common topic about how people are getting married later, woefully apparent in my own actually, no, positively apparent in my own personal life experience.
Yeah, spread joy.
And exactly. And also having kids later. But the idea that the entire relationship timeline from even meeting someone and then actually having a relationship with that person is becoming extended out further and further. And it led me down a rabbit hole towards this Stanford research report about the effects of online dating and how that's sort of obviating the process for friends and family to be introducing people to other people. And instead you're just relying on apps and that's socially acceptable now. Anyway, this whole thing got me onto this idea of how interesting it is now that the way relationships in general unfold is totally different, right? And the place that that starts is now meeting online. But there's obviously a bunch of different effects of that. And so my question is, how are we dealing with the reality that nowadays everybody meets online?
I think it's a really good question. The first thing it makes me think of is the concept of a meet cute. Which I was late.
Thinking about this too. Yeah.
Like I was late to this idea. I was not familiar with this until maybe like 2 years ago. And I was explaining that like I had gone on a date after meeting someone in a park. And someone was like, oh, you had a meet cute. And I didn't know what it was. And that's like the term for when you meet someone in real life in a cute way, which used to be called a story, which used to just be the way we met people. And now there's this specific, you know, codified terminology that's developed as a result of this.
Well, it's like a
trend.
Nora Ephron,
right?
Like rom-com concept, right? Like the idea that if you want to care about a story, it needs to have some sort of magical beginning. But like the online dating thing is good and bad in so many ways, right? Like the idea that you're having the opportunity potentially, in theory, to find someone that is like more acutely tuned to whatever it is you like are looking for in a partner. At the same time, it's forcing people to establish sort of like crazy intense expectations of what that perfect partner is, right? Like a continually narrowing thing. Like I have a friend who is not particularly tall. And he deals with the issues that short kings around the world deal with.
Right. Yeah. You can just say, I'm not willing. In fact, I was talking to a female friend of mine who's tall and she's like, I hate to admit it, but this is a deal breaker for me. And now I'm just going to narrow the pool because of it. Right. Because this idea of the pool that you're searching from, maybe it used to be the near-in community that your friends and family could introduce you to, especially before the internet. That was definitely the way that was relied on. And now it's like the pool of all eligible people anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, like that's part of it too. Like the serendipity part of meeting someone in real life, right? Like maybe you're like, I would rather date someone my height or taller if this tall woman is thinking that. But like maybe she meets some really hilarious short guy that she's like, you are my dream guy. But like if you're meeting online, you're not getting the opportunity to be surprised by someone because it is like a finite, defined set of information that you're choosing to put out there.
But I think what's really interesting is, I mean, we talk about like the intermediaries that introduce us. And I think it's easy to think of like online dating opens this pool because you're right. Like, the more people that are on there, there's this network effect of like, oh, well, we'll all just go there. But there's also the lens of like the algorithm, which by nature of your interactions with it determines what it thinks your type is, which it often isn't or sometimes is. I mean, I've heard the stories of like friends being like, I didn't realize my type was X. And then I realized that all like the algorithm told me it was and I realized it was right or vice versa, where, you know, the more you're like, all of a sudden I have only people with brown hair. And that's not even anything I care about, but it's determined that matters to me. And I don't know how to break the algorithm loop. Like, I don't know how to break out of this factor.
Yeah, for sure. Like there is, it can hone in on one type that you have, even if you have like many types, right? Like it's kind of narrowing in on one thing. But I think the digital component is one part of it, because I don't think it's like inherently that it's digital that would necessarily be the problem. I think, so I encountered this concept recently called serendipity engines, which I think is...
What I'm imagining right now is like a tiny Thomas the Tank, but with like really delightful colors and flags waving around being like, joy! Speaking of, right?
Yeah, I think the idea is just, it is... having a Thomas the Tank Engine in your head working around. It's like creating mechanisms in your life, either like tangible things or attitudes or whatever, that are sort of increasing your likelihood for serendipity, which is also, did Nora Ephron write Serendipity, the movie with John Cusack and Kate Beckinsale?
Not the guy for that.
No.
Based on the restaurant based in New York City.
Yeah. And so it's like, forcing yourself to, talk to someone at the gym every day, like talk to one person or talk to a stranger on the street or going to networking events or right, like these behaviors that you can do that can force increased opportunity for serendipity. And I actually met my wife sort of in this way in digital, like we'd known each other, but we weren't dating or anything like that. And her Twitter account had got hacked, and I got like a spam email from her Twitter account. And I was like, I had put in my head, I was like, if someone's account gets hacked anywhere at this point where the internet was at, like there's plenty of it, and you would just get emails from your friends all the time. I would make it a point to contact that person and just be like, hey, just so you know, your account got hacked. And I did it to her, and she was like, well, that's what you get for streaming illegal internet streams of the Olympics from Eastern Europe. And it just like turned into a conversation, and now we're married and have a kid. But it was just like that.
See,
behavior became
beautiful.
A serendipity engine. And I think like digital behavior or even like dating apps could work, but it's about probably like adjusting your behavior to... increase the opportunity to be surprised.
This is like the romantic version of like lucky people make their own luck. People in love make their own opportunities to fall in love.
Right. And it's funny because even hearing that story, it's like, it makes me so happy. And it's like, oh, what a delight. That's so perfect. Like, what are the odds? And I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before, but this is something I've definitely talked about with a bunch of my friends, of this idea that even though online dating is a lot more acceptable now socially and the most common way people meet each other, there is something inherently valuable about this idea of fate and like beating whatever odds there were that you and Becky would end up together, Joey, of this one random email that turned into a conversation. Like, there's something special about that. And so I guess, is there a space here where it's like, if we think that that's so important, is the real answer to not, if we really want to meet somebody, as Stephen, you had said, in real life or whatever, is the strategy or our own personal algorithm about making those serendipity engines for ourselves?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we're always drawn to what's novel, right? And so if there's a story of like when Tinder was first coming out or Hinge or Bumble, I mean, a lot of the effects of these new dating apps comes on, it's a new one with a new mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Like if we're always drawn to the novel thing, then in theory, there's a cool opportunity to force yourself to get excited mm-hmm. about the new thing, which is just being analog.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's another thing about agency. Like you have the ability to decide what you want to do and what you want to get excited about. And the ability to build these serendipity engines into your life, if you so choose.
Yeah, I mean, there's a new one that I've been getting podcast ads about called Chip, which if they're willing, you can send us our check now that we're giving you a
That's
plug.
That's right.
Use code Joey.
Yeah.
just Joey, lowercase.
Use code, this is what a Joey sounds like. But they allow your friends to be part of your dating.
Oh, right.
We can help Jess find someone on this app where we're like, oh, I think you would actually like this person because I know you better than you know yourself or something, which is like a new dynamic, but potentially creates a serendipity engine because it's another focused attention on the endeavor of finding someone right?
Is that a serendipity engine, or is that just the digital version of the way things used to be with friends introducing you to other people?
Right, but your friends are a serendipity engine, right?
Whoa.
Because they're like a random generator, and if you have a strong enough relationship, they're out in the world thinking about you and being like, you should meet Jess.
Wow. That would be awesome. Great friends should be looking out for their friends everywhere.
I want to talk about the other part of this article that we very much got sidetracked on in this part of the conversation, and that's my fault.
Not at all.
But the extension of the timelines is like, there's another part of that, which is even, right, like the timeline to get married has like more than doubled from whatever it was, the 70s or the 60s.
Yeah.
Right, almost 6 years before people are getting married. But the big part that I thought was interesting is that even the point from like meeting someone to, in quotes, being romantic, I don't know,
which
what
I
that,
take a lot of, I have a lot of umbrage with,
yeah,
towards
being romantic,
that terminology, like what does that mean?
Hey, they did a study, it must be operationally defined,
it's
in
defined
there,
somewhere,
yeah, it's,
but in
be.
This top line from the article, it's like, oh yeah, this is when people are romantic, whatever that means.
Holding hands,
right.
Heavy petting.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, this is the PG-13 portion of the
what
podcast.
Base? What base?
Oh my God.
But that timeline has doubled, right? Like it went from one month to 2 months, but doubling is a lot, right? Like that's kind of a big deal that you're, and that might be a factor of this digital, like, choice paralysis or extreme specific expectations might be a component of it. Like, you really need to be convinced that that person is funny or nice or like handsome or pretty enough to check some box. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Or the reality that these people just genuinely might be more removed from you, right? Because if you don't have the intermediary of a friend or family, they are more strangers, right? Degrees of separation wise, they might be further away. And so maybe you just need more time to get to know them.
Also serendipity engines.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, how are you, Steven? Put you on blast.
Yeah, I'm here.
How are you meeting people that you like start to date or things like that? Is it all digital or is it friends or?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a mix of both, right? Like it's certainly easiest, apps are easiest, which is weird because that feels like it would be the hardest.
Yeah.
But it's also the lowest cost. So I think one of the side effects, maybe positive, maybe negative, of digitally launched dates, digitally induced dates, whatever we want to call it, is that there's almost no cost to it.
Right.
Like having a bad date is meaningless if it's with a stranger who you don't know, and there's no pressure if you haven't been introduced by a friend.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, and it's funny, I've talked to friends who we often like will compare what we do on dates, like, do you go for drinks? Like, how do you plan it? And I've had friends who have completely different strategies with regards to like, oh yeah, I go to the same bar every time because like I'm just here to like get to know this person and see if we're a match. Whereas for me, I'm like, no. If it's a stranger, I'm just going to do something I think is fun and I will bring a stranger along. And if they also have fun, check.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I'm like the king of the 10 a.m. date of like, let's meet for coffee and then walk around for an hour and a half because I think that's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. And hey, if it's also low investment or cost and also high prospect in the sense that since everybody is meeting online nowadays, maybe that's where all the best people are hiding too.
Hmm.
So low cost and potentially high reward.
Yeah, I don't make recommendations for dates to people anymore. And I used to do it all the time. Like, oh, you should meet this person. You guys would like this same album. You know, like, I don't know. Like, now
highly
it's,
unlikely.
Now I'm like, there's a lot of pressure. Like, I'm friends with you and people are dating weird now, so I'm just like, I want to stay out of it.
Yeah, so maybe we just are just as weird as we ever were about dealing with meeting people online, even though we're all doing it. We're all just flailing at it together.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in New York, New York.
We'd like to thank special guest host Stephen Ebert and, of course, executive producer and dating coach Jess Vander.
Yikes. Yep. We'd like to thank sound engineer Alex Contell.
Designer Nora Mestrich for just making the designs.
Yep. And with production help from Sari Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Wong.
And as always,
thanks Alan.
Special thanks.
Special
Boy,
thanks.
Have we got them.
Wow.
Thank you, Aaron, for letting me borrow your headphones. I didn't bring any today, and I stole yours off your desk.
Sorry, Aaron.
Yeah. I should have asked. I didn't.
Lice. I'd like to thank Rid for getting rid of lice.
I'd like to thank my fifth grade teacher, Miss Miller, for discovering that I don't have lice.
Okay, I would like to thank the movie The Holiday for teaching me about the subject of meet cutes from the fictional director in the film.
I would not like to
thank... Best Christmas movie ever.
I would not like to thank that opinion is what I was going to say.
I know how you feel about The Holiday, Joey.
I think it's fine.
Okay.
It's
well,
no
that's
serendipity,
just
that's oh for sure. Goodness. I'd like to thank John Cusack for giving me the movie...
Many movies.
High Fidelity.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to thank Adam, who I met cute in a park and haven't seen since. Hope you're enjoying Nashville, wherever you live.
Thanks for ghosting me, Adam. I'd like to thank emotions.
For feeling?
Yeah, for like the having them and feeling them.
I'd like to thank Anne Hathaway for teaching my mom to choose joy and for whatever terrible magazine did the interview with her in which she said this.
I'd like to thank Stephen and Tony's method of evaluating their own personal emotions on a scale from 0 to 100, where Stephen is usually an 83 and Tony is usually in the 20s.
Yeah, that was just, you know, what you feel yeah. the number is, right?
Yeah, like what's your number?
This right. feels like your number. And it's a universal, right? It's not, is it day to day? Is it the weather? Or is it the forecast?
What's your baseline? What's your baseline?
Is baseline zero? Zero
no,
to 100?
Your baseline, like basal.
Oh, got it. So like the average temperature in Tampa Bay is 70 degrees.
Yeah.
The are average you a 70? Number of emotion for me?
Yeah.
Honestly,
your happiness,
I'm too,
your happiness index.
I might be too turbulent to have an average temperature. Yeah.
Jess, that's not how averages work. I'd like to thank special guest host averages and statistics and probabilities.
And math.
Good day, sir.
Good day.
Bye.
Let's meet cute.
Choose joy.